starting with a reading from the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. And that was a real place. It was in Southern Virginia, and that's where families used to take people who were epileptics or feeble-minded or had mental illnesses. This reading is by Molly McCulley Brown. There are fine metal bars on the window, 50 metal beds. The floor is white linoleum. The admissions rate has been cut back to 5 a week to combat overcrowding. It smells of chemicals and sweat. Every other moment, someone else begins to yell. None of this should be at all surprising. But this looks like the loveliest building in the colony. Deep blue doors, tall white columns, brick trimmed in wrought iron and kudzu. Elsewhere, this is the year that Scarlett O'Hara falls in love with Tara. Here, the year some 1,500 people are cut open and wrecked. Mostly, they do not know what is happening, that the lights going out suddenly in their windows will never come back on. Jan mentioned in her introduction that Susan and I have been attending this congregation since just after the turn of this century. We used to say that about the 20th century, but now it's about the 21st. And in that time, many of you have come to know that I'm really interested in bringing stories of historical Unitarian Universalists to life. I'm fascinated with investigating how people deal with the circumstances in which they live, and I'm even more interested in making connections with those things and the choices that we make today. Everyone has a personal sphere of influence involving family and friends, and people who are involved in the lives of their family and friends outside of that also have a public sphere of influence. Between those two spheres lies what I call a space for grace, and that's the place in which things can change unexpectedly, increasing the size of a person's sphere of influence. Sometimes there are rational reasons why that happens, and sometimes it seems to happen for no reason at all, when the only way to account for what happens is through grace itself. And both of those things, the unexpected and the rational, help us to understand why Dorothea Dix led the life that she did in the middle of the 19th century. Once I began looking into her life, I paid attention to anything that was related to her primary interests. She was a member of the Unitarian congregation that was led by one of our renowned ministers, the Reverend William Ellery Channing. And in the early 19th century, after meeting with Quakers in Britain, she took up the cause of how people living with mental illnesses were treated. It didn't take long for me to find out that there are resources on how these people and their families are being treated today, and that's one of the things that I'm here to talk to you about. Before I go further, I should tell you that my interest in Dorothea Dix's work has a personal element as well. One of our sons has bipolar disorder, which manifested itself during his adolescence. And in addition, I grew up in a family with a history of substance abuse and alcohol that goes back generations. I also have a nephew who's a sociopath. He's imprisoned following a violent attack on one of his cousins that resulted in permanent brain injury and blindness. Some of you may have personal reasons to listen to this sermon as well, because you also may have family reasons why this is of interest to you, as is the work of Dorothea Dix. One of the resources I used in preparing this sermon won't surprise you at all. I went to the website that's created by Unitarian Universalist historians to find a basic biographical sketch of her life. I found my other primary resource by paying attention to things that were all around me, which is what happens when you start looking for things, you find them. And so that's how I found an article in the April 9th edition of the New York Times, a review of this book, written by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Powers. The title of this book is "No One Cares About Crazy People: The Chaos and Heartbreak of Mental Health in America." And the title itself hooked me immediately. So I went and found the book and read it. The title is taken from a sort of careless throwaway remark that was made by a woman named Kelly Rindfleisch. She was on the staff of somebody who was at that time Milwaukee County's chief executive. His name, you won't be surprised to learn, is Scott Walker. And Scott Walker has now become the governor of Wisconsin. Scott Walker is a politician who has come to play a much more active role. But at the time that he was interested in how people might react to a series of disclosures about how people with profound mental illnesses were being treated in Milwaukee, and the answer was that at that time they were being starved, they were sexually abused, they were living in filth, and cruelly confined in Milwaukee's county hospital. That would not have surprised Dorothea Dix at all, nor would the conditions in that hospital. In 1841, Dorothea Dix was described as a tiny little woman, a devout Unitarian. Her dark hair parted severely in the middle and tied in a bun behind, which made her ears stick out. She was about as big as someone in our congregation. This is Barbara Eck, and that's why Barbara's wearing this hat. When we're talking about Victorians, we tend to wear Victorian hats that have been collected up by Judith, who loans them to us. Barbara is somebody who every day demonstrates that the power to exert great influence can come in a very small package. Thanks, Barbara. Dorothea Dix lived in Boston and had spent time in England, where Quakers introduced her to the contempt and abuse shown to patients in institutions such as the hospital that came to be known as Bedlam. Its real name was the Bethlehem Hospital, but in Cockney slang, that turned into Bedlam. When she came back to the United States, back to her congregation led by William Ellery Channing, and he asked her to go down to the local jail in Boston and to teach women inmates something of interest, she said, sure. When she got to the jail, she was amazed to learn that many of the people that she was supposed to be teaching had profound mental illnesses. She was also appalled to learn that their living conditions were very similar to the ones that she'd found in London. So she decided to visit other prisons and jails in the Boston area, and she found the same dreadful living conditions for inmates who had mental illness. She herself had tuberculosis, but she decided that she should travel the state of Massachusetts to see what life was like for other people. And as a result, she was determined to speak to the Massachusetts legislature about what she had found, to demand funding for improvements in living conditions. Now, at that time, women were not allowed to speak to the legislature. And that meant that she had to work with other Unitarian men, such as Horace Mann and Samuel Gridley Howe, and she prepared what she titled the memorial. You heard Jan read a part of that memorial earlier in the service. She demanded change. She said, it's an outrage that people live in these conditions, and the legislature must provide funding so that we can do better. Howe was a member of the Massachusetts legislature, and he shepherded a request for funding for new institutions where people would be treated humanely. They called that moral treatment. And he ended up with enough money to establish a hospital where people would use moral treatment. And it had 150 beds in it. At the time, they were the only 150 beds where people with mental illnesses would be guaranteed to be treated humanely. She ended up traveling all over the United States, 30,000 miles by stagecoach, horses, trains, whatever way she could find to get around this great country. During the Civil War, she took a little break. She served as the superintendent of the Army of Nurses for the Union, but she cared for Union and Confederate soldiers alike. And when the war was over, and there was nothing more that she could do for wounded soldiers, she returned to the cause of her life, which was to find better treatment for people with mental illness. She played a direct role in the establishment of 32 institutions where people were used moral treatment to help to improve the living conditions for her patients. And when she died in 1887, She had helped to transform standards of care and the lives of thousands of patients and their families. Dorothea Dix is a person who would not have agreed with the title of this book, No One Cares About Crazy People, because she did care. She personified what we say today in our first and second principles in our faith community. We talk about the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We talk about justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. She swept away ideas of how people with mental illnesses should be treated. Those ideas had existed for thousands of years, but she wanted change and she got it. And her work, this tiny little woman, changed the world. Most of you are aware of what happened to those changes in the middle of the century that followed her death in the United States. Based on the discoveries of Charles Darwin and others about human evolution, some politicians and industrialists decided that the answer to how humans should be treated had to do with natural selection, and that part of natural selection should be forced sterilization of people who were taken by their families because they didn't know where else to take them, to places like the Virginia colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. And those sterilizations were done without informed consent because they didn't want people able to reproduce children who might also have mental illnesses and were described by society as lunatics or idiots. And in case you think that that's something that happened only in the century where Dorothea Dix lived, you may be surprised to learn that forced sterilization ended in the state of California in September of 2014, when Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill finally ending the rights of physicians to sterilize patients that they deemed unacceptable. In the 14 years of the 21st century, when these laws were still in effect, more than 185 men and women were sterilized in California institutions. I didn't look up the figures for North Carolina, but I can assure you that that's exactly what happened here as well. 4 years ago, these practices finally ended. You also may not know that people with mental illnesses or developmental delays were the subjects of trial runs for what became known as the final solution that was used in Nazi Germany. They were the people on whom Zyklon B was tried first to see if it was going to work. It worked all right, and that's why Zyklon B was the gas that was chosen for the extermination camps later run by SS commanders. In this country, moral treatment instituted by Dorothea Dix and her followers was felt to be a little soft, and not only that, it cost money. And so it was gradually replaced with exactly the same kinds of conditions that she had found at Bedlam and other mental hospitals. And we all know that by the 1970s, local and state governments had grown tired of providing care at all for such patients. There's never enough money in local, state, and federal budgets to care for people whose behavior can terrify average citizens. So in the mid-1970s, responsibility for their care was systematically handed over to local governments, which lacked knowledge, skills, information, and funding, not to mention will and desire, to improve conditions, who could neither vote nor fund political campaigns. Well, what was the solution? The solution was to close those places, those publicly funded mental hospitals, and simply turn their patients out. Since local resources were non-existent, that's why people like that ended up in the streets as homeless and destitute, or in our detention centers and jails and prisons, where today they make up about 20% of all the people incarcerated there. Now, unlike adults, children and youth who can be treated once they develop symptoms of mental illness or developmental delay, if such treatments are available to their families, can involve medication, except those medications also have side effects. So I'm not saying that any of this is easy to figure out. I'm simply saying that Dorothea Dix helped to make us responsible. We who call ourselves Unitarian Universalists today need to join her in what she did in exploring the ways that we are going to be responsible for people who cannot be responsible for themselves. Their numbers are about 10 million in this country today, And today, there are a total of around 45,000 beds to treat them with. 10 million people, 45,000 beds. I think you can all subtract and figure out how many people that leaves completely untreated or for whom no resources are available at all. Fewer and fewer medical students today are going into psychiatry, in part because of the mistaken belief that medications like Haldol and Thorazine have solved these complex issues. Well, they haven't. We still have bipolar disorder, we still have schizophrenia, and those are only the big mental illnesses. There are many, many others that still need to be treated. And unless a patient with mental illness consents to treatment, he or she can only be treated if he or she is regarded as a danger to self or others. And that usually means an act of horrific violence or attempted suicide before someone will say, we will mandate treatment for this patient. And even if treatment is mandated, we still go back to those, how many beds was it? 45,000 to treat 10 million people. We're actually lucky here in Hendersonville because we have a community resource that has made a huge difference in how people with mental illnesses are treated. According to an article that I found in the March 9th, 2017 edition of the Hendersonville Lightning, this particular nonprofit organization saved the taxpayers of this county more than $277,000 last year in prescribed medications for patients. Does anybody here, bar one person, does anybody else know what this organization is? It's the free clinics. And the person who runs the free clinics is sitting in the front row. This is Judy Long. She's the executive director, and she is also the community-based minister who's connected with this congregation. And here's what she told me just last week about why the free clinic's board, staff, and volunteers have chosen to take up the cause of people with mental illness who are also incarcerated in the Henderson County Detention Center. For more than 10 years, the state of North Carolina has been discussing mental health care. Consistent, high-quality care has been a struggle during this time. The free clinics stepped in to help pick up the slack. In addition to offering psychiatric care on site, the free clinic's pharmacy, with a long list of medications that can be used to treat mental illnesses, has been able to support the entire community, including the detention center. We were able to obtain prescribed medications for inmates through our pharmacy, so at least they're receiving some of the care they need. The clinics will continue to be involved in the provisions for mental health care, and we are actively engaged in community-wide planning efforts to address the needs of people with mental illness in this community. And for those of you who have a personal interest in mental illness and its care, you might want to talk to Judy about how you could volunteer at the free clinics and be part of this solution that other places don't have, but we do. The free clinics are providing services today to help meet needs that simply would otherwise go unmet. This doesn't mean that people with mental illnesses or developmental delays belong in detention center. It means that's where public inattention and repugnance have put them. People find it difficult to remember that these people and their families, and of course that means our families, deserve to be treated with kindness and respect like any other human being. How and where their mental illnesses are treated is one thing that we, who are members of the same faith community as Dorothea Lynn Dix, might want to pay attention to. So here are some of the things that we might think about doing. We could sponsor a community-wide discussion on mental illness. We could sponsor training for adults who might serve as first responders for children and youth who have mental illness, because that's about 20% of the children and youth that we welcome here. Those children and youth at some point in their lives are going to discover that they have a mental illness, or their families will. They usually call it a condition because the term mental illness or developmental delay are seen as judgmental. But if we were to have training as first responders, adults here could play a critical role in their lives in giving them someone to talk to, which they desperately need. Those are the same children who participate in our family ministries program. and training for first responders would be available for the asking if we were to ask to sponsor it. That might mean that we could encourage one another to talk about how we are affected personally by mental illness in our families, because what's true in our families is true in some of yours as well. I want to be more open about these issues, and I think that we might find common ground for some of our concerns if we were. The question that I'm asking you this morning is not only are you interested in Dorothea Dix, she was a fascinating person, but equally important, what are we going to do about this? Ron Powers wrote, "I hope you don't enjoy this book. I hope you are wounded by it, wounded as I have been in writing it, wounded to act, to intervene, because only if this happens and keeps happening until it needs happen no more, can we dare to hope that my sons and all their brothers and sisters in psychotic suffering are redeemed, that they have not suffered entirely in vain." The bottom line for us as Unitarian Universalists is that we are called to act for justice. If the work of Dorothea Dix doesn't call to us, I hope that someone else's work does. There's no end to the number of issues that we could pay attention to here in Western North Carolina. One of the religious education curricula developed by Unitarian Universalists who are involved in family ministries is called Heeding the Call, the Qualities of a Justice Maker. And those qualities include awareness, understanding, empathy, courage, cooperation, forgiveness, and leadership, as well as knowledge of our heritage as Unitarian Universalists. How will you choose to answer that call as an individual? And how might we as a congregation choose to do so? We have this marvelous resource in our midst. How can we support it better? Dorothea Dix answered the specific call that the Reverend William Ellery Channing directed to her. There is no record of how she felt about it when he asked her to go teach that class in a jail. I wonder how you might feel if someone asked you to teach a class in a jail. But there is a record of what she did once she became aware of how people were being treated. We have really come full circle in this country because the institutions that she helped to establish have all been closed down. And once again, where do we find people like this? We find them in our jails, in our prisons, and in our detention centers, or homeless on the street. They didn't ask for that outcome. That's just where people who meet up with the criminal justice system end up. To learn more about the lives of people with mental illnesses who are scheduled, sometimes for months or years, to appear in court and can't make bail, this is another book I found when I was looking for things that might pertain to this subject. This one's called Sometimes Amazing Things Happen, and this is by a psychiatrist named Elizabeth Ford. She wrote it because she treats people in the justice system exclusively, so that you could learn what it was like when schizophrenia or bipolar disorder keep you imprisoned or a family member, and what it's like for staff and correctional officers to have to deal with the symptoms of mental illness in addition to the consequences of criminal offense. That's a burden that we have placed on everyone who's involved in the system. Dorothea Dix would tell us it's time for us to pay attention again, to write manifestos, to go to our state legislature, to tell them what we need and want, and to demand funding as well, because more humane treatment is just the starting point. I wonder if we will be the ones who will put paid to these cruel words that Kelly Rindfleisch wrote about. Nobody's interested in crazy people. Do we have to wait for someone with a mental illness to shoot kindergartners or first graders or their teachers before we demand regulations that prevent people like that from purchasing firearms? How will we interpret justice, equity, and compassion in human relations for people with mental illnesses here in Western North Carolina? Dorothea Dix might at some point in her life have felt that her personal sphere of influence was pretty small, because she was pretty small. But her tenacity and resolve resulted in her being able to create a huge sphere of public influence. We can use her life as an example of how we might enlarge that space for grace in our own lives, as an example of what one determined person can do. We had an example of how to do this just last week when the Social Justice Task Group brought us all those postcards and provided pens and addresses and things to write about so that we could get some kinds of messages through to our legislators. Dorothea Dix paid attention to everything that was happening all around her, and she decided that she had a responsibility to change things for the better for people who could not advocate for themselves. She continued to do this until the end of her life. I hope that we can do what she did in big ways and small. I hope that is what we choose to do. But I want to give you an epilogue as well, something that I wrote yesterday, because yesterday is when I found an account of what was going on. Remember the Milwaukee County Hospital where people were being treated so badly? Well, there's a current case in that same institution, still in Milwaukee, that involves a patient and an inmate named Terrell Thomas. And I'm going to read this newspaper article to you. Just a few hours into Terrell Thomas's eighth day in solitary confinement in the Milwaukee County Jail last year, correction officers found the 38-year-old man on the ground, not moving. He was dead. He had spent his final days begging for water, inmates later told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, because jail staff had turned off the flow of water to his cell as a punishment for his bad behavior. The cause of his death was profound dehydration, and the medical examiner classified this as a homicide, meaning death at the hands of other people, an announcement that drew a torrent of rage from Sheriff David Clark. Thomas had been moved to solitary confinement in the discipline unit after he used his bedding to flood his jail cell in the special needs unit where he was being kept because he had bipolar disorder. The order to shut off Mr. Thomas's water is highly irregular and contrary to standard operating procedure in the jail, a spokesperson said Monday, according to the Journal Sentinel, and told jurors that they will hear from fellow inmates who claim that he called constantly for water. He also said there is evidence that his compromised mental health made it clear that he was unable to tell people about his basic needs. Thomas had been in the county jail 8 days for allegedly shooting a gun at a group of men standing outside. One man was hit in the chest and underwent surgery, and according to court documents, he was aiming at a man that he believed had stolen his car the day before. He later went to the Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino in Milwaukee, where he fired that gun into the air several times, yelled for everyone to get on the ground, and claimed that there were snakes everywhere, and then scooped up poker chips and put them in his pockets. When police arrived, he dropped that gun into a garbage can and lay on the ground, according to reports. He faced 5 charges and a maximum of more than 60 years in prison for what he did. His family said that he was having a mental breakdown when he committed those crimes. The man's sons filed a lawsuit in federal court last month, claiming that their father was subjected to a form of torture during his time in solitary confinement and that officers ignored his plea for help. The lawsuit claimed that police took him for a hospital examination after he was disruptive at the jail and showed signs of acute psychological disorder. The hospital cleared him for transport, and days before he died, a judge had ordered a competency hearing for Mr. Thomas. I wonder if there's any way that our congregation might change the outcome of a story like this one, because it's very real and it's very current.